Verse 7, then, is the positive side, the power and righteousness of God. Sin that is repented of, then God is good and a stronghold in the day of trouble. He knows them that trust in him. The Assyrian obviously is trusting in themselves. The contrast here is for Israel and Judah, which have been taken captive at this point. All but Jerusalem itself, but you know, much of the countryside of Judah. All of Israel is captive. And it's a message to them to know God, to trust in him. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6 ought to be tied in with that. 2 Timothy 2, verse 19, God knows his own. God knows his own. The fact that God is a protection to the obedient, Isaiah 26, verses 20 through 21. Isaiah 26, 20 through 21. God is protection to the obedient. Let me finish up verse 8, which ends this section, then I'll take questions. And with an overrunning flood, he will make an utter end to the place thereof, and darkness shall pursue his enemies. He's going to be the punishment then to the disobedient. With an overrunning flood. In fact, Nineveh had a flood that broke down its gates in 612. A flood broke down the gates of Nineveh in 612. And I have a reference there that makes absolutely no sense. It won't work. I'll look it up. Secondly, so you have a literal flood that comes in the waters. But secondly, you have the armies that flooded in. The Babylonian armies that then took Nineveh. Isaiah 8, verses 7 and 8. And that must be Isaiah 6. That's probably why I wrote that down and I never did put the book, which is brilliant. It won't work for Nahum, obviously, because there aren't six chapters in Nahum. No, it doesn't work for that either. Anyway, I'll have to look that up later. But you do have Isaiah 8, verses 7 and 8, which it talks about the past, the future of this taking place. It would be found in Revelation 12, verses 15 through 16. And we're talking there about the aspect of a flood and the typology that is used here is a flood of armies coming in to take the land. In Revelation 12, we have the account of the church going to a place of safety. And at that particular point, it says that Satan gets angry, sends a flood after her, and the earth opens up to take that flood. You know, is that quite literal? It was back when Assyria fell. You know, I guess we could conjure up some idea of that, maybe. I think more applicable, I was going to say more literal, but less literal, but more applicable, is the aspect of armies as a flood coming in and taking the land. Okay, quick question. Point number six is a protection to the obedience. It is the power and righteousness of God. The power and righteousness of God for the obedient. So we have point one was zealousness for Israel. Point two was angry at sin. Part of his character to be angry at sin, to warn of consequences is three. Number four is that he has power over the elements and exerts that at times, and that he executes power over sin is point number five. He executes that power. He does not do it speedily is an aspect of that that we covered in Ecclesiastes 8. And he provides protection to the faithful, is point number six. The righteousness of God to protect the obedient. And we see that in the future. We see quite a correlation between what happened then with what's going to happen in the future. He will protect those who trust in God and maintain that trust. Okay, then we find verses 9 through 15 is the punishment of God's enemies and his preservation of the faithful. And he spends time on this. What do you imagine against the eternal? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. He says Armageddon is going to be enough. So, you know, we go back and forth. It did happen to Assyria. The fall of Nineveh was enough. It destroyed Assyria. First fulfillment. Second fulfillment, Assyria will arise again as the beast powers, and again there will be a battle that will be enough. And Armageddon is going to be enough. It is going to decimate those nations that come against Christ. That's going to be the end of it. There's going to be, in some place, I think it talks about 7 months cleaning up the blood. Impregnable, verse 10. For while they be folded together as thorns and drunk as drunkards, they shall be devoured as a stubble fully dry. I mean, they think they're so good. I mean, if you spend any time around bars, I don't recommend that you spend a lot of time around bars. Though oftentimes they can hardly walk around, but you can convince them because their brains are, well, they're brain dead. They shall be devoured as a stubble fully dry, as a fire goes through a land. And that stubble that's dry as it burns right up. We see that imagery of stubble fully dry in Matthew 13:30, Obadiah 18, it was Matthew 13:30, Obadiah 18, Isaiah 5, verse 24, Joel 2, verse 5. Here in verse 11, speculation as to who that would be, we don't know as far as a past figure. Maybe Sennacherib's leading counselor. We don't have a name for that, I guess. But you'd look in the future, the counselors that counsel the beast and the false prophet, that it could be speaking of either one of those. Verse 12, thus says the Eternal, though they be quiet, likewise, yet they shall be cut down. It says the yoke of Assyria on Judah is to be broken. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. For now I will break his yoke from off you and will burst your bonds in sunder. It is talking here to Judah. This is the comfort to Judah that though I have afflicted you, though Judah is afflicted, so that you there is Judah, I will afflict you, Judah, no more. For now will I break his yoke from off of you. His is, of course, Assyria's yoke from off of Judah, and will burst your bonds in sunder, Judah's bonds in sunder, so that the Assyrian would be taken off of them because of Babylon coming in. Now, unfortunately, Judah still didn't repent, and Babylon then took Judah. The Assyrian progeny was to be cut off in verse 14, no more of your name be sown. Progeny cut off. False gods would be destroyed, the last half of verse 14. God is not a God of freedom of religion. Now, he allows it now. It is the best environment for the work to thrive. And therefore, we believe in freedom of religion in today's society, and we would promote that. We have promoted that in the past when there has been a closing of the vice on religious freedom, because we know what that would do to the work being done now. We wish to wait until Christ closes the vice on religious freedom, and that he will then define religion. Then verse 15, admonition to keep the feasts, perform your vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through you. He is utterly cut off. Obviously, the fulfillment of this is in the millennium. That in the millennium there is going to be peace. Isaiah 52, verse 7. Isaiah 52, verse 7 speaks of the millennial peace. There's going to be these good tidings that publishes peace. And there is speculation that this could then refer to Hezekiah and some of his reforms in 701, which is why some even put it up, you know, before the fall of Thebes. You know, I think I've presented the position that it is, you know, it would be much more predominantly after the fall of Thebes, but could even, you know, there's a residual effect of what happened some 50, 60 years earlier with the reforms and a call to the nation to reform once again during the time of Josiah. Chapter 2, then, is the siege of Nineveh. We see three sections to the chapter. Verses 1 through 6 is the siege of Nineveh itself. The time period as they are going to take it, we see that he that dashes in pieces has come up before your face. Keep the munition, watch the way, make your loins strong, fortify your power mightily. It's kind of a taunt, as I said, this dirge. You know, come on, go ahead and put your loin armor on, said, felt invincible. So God says, okay, do your best. Give it your best shot and see if you can make it. For the Eternal has turned away the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. He's saying, well, Jacob has been disciplined as much as need to be disciplined at that particular point. For the emptiers have emptied them out, marred their vine branches. The Assyrians had taken them, plundered them. We see the pre-assault here. The shield of his mighty men is made red, and this is apparently talking about the oncoming army, the pre-assault. Here they're parading around Nineveh, and they're showing their colors, as often was done before the battle, to see if they would surrender. Media's colors were red. The army of Media was in red. The valiant men are in scarlet. It's easy to tell them apart when they were in the battle and when the cameras were rolling, so you could tell on either side. The chariot shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation. The fir trees shall be terribly shaken. The fir trees, apparently the better translation is the chargers. The chargers prance. It's these horses that are walking around the city, outside the gates of Nineveh, and they're walking around prancing, eager to get on with the battle. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one another in the broad ways. They seem like torches. They run like lightnings, the strength of the Median army. He shall recount his worthies. The armies, then, that may just be me hitting it, I don't know. The officers lead the attack, verse 5. And the defense shall be prepared. Defense, the word is mantele, mantalet, or at least this is a rendition of it. It was a covering that was movable, that was used for final plans. It's like a tent that they would have, that they would get together their officers and whatever that would cover them. He says it's ready to be moved, it's prepared, so they can put together their final plans. The gates of the rivers shall be open, and the palace shall be dissolved. Palace being dissolved, the foundations would be loosened. The gates of the river shall be opened. The Babylonian army captured the sluice gates controlling the river, and then they flooded the city. Chapter 1, verse 8. Babylon flooded the city. And Huzzab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and her maid shall lead her as the voice of doves tabering upon their breasts. Breasts. Did I say that right? Huzzab may be a personal name. It may be representing the queen of Assyria, that she would be led away captive. It could be a name that is representative of the religious leadership. For instance, Ishtar is a name that was the goddess of Nineveh, so maybe this is a reference to her or to a similar being. The Revised Standard Version, I think, says the mistress shall be led away. And it could mean, third possibility is women in general. In other words, Huzzab is representative of the women. The women are going to be taken. Or it could be more specifically the queen, to be led away captive, brought up, her maid shall lead her as the voice of doves. That when doves get in distress, they start cooing as loudly as they can, panicking, as though beating, tabering is beating upon their breaths. Verse 8 then, Nineveh is of old like a pool of water, yet shall she flee away. Nineveh was like a pool of water. He's talking here about the fact of many tributaries coming into a land. And with all the tributaries, as you think of the Tigris and the Euphrates and all the water, a very rich land from the aspect of what it could be if there weren't the problems with politics and many of these other things. We were in Syria, which was a part of Nineveh at that point, and they had a fantastic crop, the best one they'd had in 50 years here about 3 years ago when we were there. And walking in the evening out through the fields, it was just like being in Kansas. All the grain, you know, as high as it was growing, and the fantastic crops. The government takes almost all their crops. They leave them something like 10 bags, you know, depending on how many children they have and how much land, they get some bags of grain to keep to make their bread in the course of the year, and then the government takes all the rest of it in that particular land. But here is the wealth of Nineveh with all these tributaries that enables them to have their wealth. Yet you shall flee away, saying, stand, stand to their armies. You know, stand and fight. You know, don't leave the battlefield. And yet they're all going to panic and run. None shall look back. Take you the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end to the store and the glory out of the pleasant furniture. So then there would be house-to-house plunder of the Assyrians, just like they had done to Israel and Judah. Nineveh then lies waste. So we had the siege, verses 1 through 6. We have the sack of Nineveh, verses 7 through 10. So she lies wasted, verse 10. She's empty, she's void, she's waste. And the heart melts, the knees smite together, much pain is in all the loins, the faces of them is blackness. So, and I believe the war, the dates I have is 616 to 612. I mean, we're not talking the 100 days of Schwarzkopf, taking the Iraq. We're talking long sieges and battles that took place. Finally, they fell in 612. And a lot of times there would be a siege and then they would leave them. Most of the battles took place in the spring and the summer. When winter came, they went back home or they left, a smaller army there, and we talk in the Old Testament, it says the time of war came. Well, the time of war was when it was dry enough and the weather was good enough that they could fight. The Russians wished that someone had believed in that, back in World War I, World War II. Verses 11 through 13 is the overthrow of Assyria. Then a recapitulation or the talk of all of Assyria falling, not just Nineveh. Conquered Assyria, who had conquered others like lions. They were fearless, they were strong. Now they are defeated. The lion did tear in pieces enough for his whelps, verse 12, and strangled for his lionesses and filled his holes with prey and his dens with ravine. But I am against you, says the Eternal of Hosts. I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. So the nation was to be destroyed. The nation of Assyria we date to about 606, 605. The fall of Nineveh is really the beginning of the decimation of Assyria. So when they lose Nineveh, their capital city, then eventually Babylon goes through, and by 606, 605, at the time that Nebuchadnezzar comes on the scene, then Babylon takes over entirely. Now we have the Babylonian Empire. The Assyrian Empire does not exist. So the lions would then die. What about the future is a question that comes up. The future fulfillment of this is in Assyria as they go through battle after battle. The first woe, I suppose more specifically, the second woe, which is the eastern hordes coming against Assyria and coming against the beast powers and all the battles that take place, is then finally with Armageddon, then she is totally destroyed. So it would take it at that point, the destruction that takes place. Chapter 3, then, is a war song. A war song, verses 1 through 7, the idolatry of Assyria leads to their ruin. And this is very poetic. Nahum, again, the poet. Woe to the bloody city. This is talking about Nineveh as the bloody city. Now we'll find elsewhere there is a reference to a sinful city that's talking about Jerusalem. And at this particular point, though, we're talking about the wickedness, full of lies and robbery. The prey departs not. The noise of a whip, the noise of the rattling of wheels, prancing horses, all these things are going to then come against Assyria. Why? Verse 4, because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favored harlot. In other words, the idolatry, the religious, the spiritual harlotry. Idolatry that was taking place, the mistress of witchcrafts, giving to superstition and to idolatry, that sells nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcrafts. Behold, I am against you, says the Eternal. I will discover your skirts upon your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. Then verses 8 through 15 is a comparison of the fall of Nineveh to the destruction of Egypt. We've already covered that. At least through verse 10, I think we went through. Let's pick it up with verse 11. You, Assyria, shall be like thieves. You shall be drunken. You shall be hid because you seek strength because of the enemy. All your strongholds shall be like fig trees with the first ripe figs. If they be shaken, they shall fall into the mouth of the eater. In other words, the outer ring, at this particular time, when the prophecies come across, and this is why we think a little bit more towards 620, that time period, the outer ring of fortresses are ready to be taken. So that then your capital city that is the most fortified, eventually then Nineveh will be taken. But it's like the fig trees that you shake them with the ripe fruit, and then you know they all this fruit starts dropping. The same would happen then to Assyria. Behold, your people are in the midst of you are women. No disparaging comment, ladies. However, when you think of an army being made up of women, what do you think of? Do you think of great strength and the ability to, you know, and especially at this particular time when you're talking about the carrying of armor, rather heavy, and fighting the battles. It has basically through time been men's job of defending cities and defending the women and children. Now we find with the Israeli army and now with this was really the first battle that American women have fought side by side, and some have died. I know they made much ado about the one woman who died in the helicopter crash. I don't think that was in battle per se, but it was in the time period of the battles. And I don't know, anyone heard how many women died in battle? None of the ladies know how many? I have not heard any statement. I do know that one woman that was, maybe there was only one. That's why, that's all you heard. One captured, one killed? James? Okay, that's where some of that. So, as a result of war, though, I mean, we can readily say that as a result of war and our involvement there and women involvement in the armies, three or four, however many it was, then died. But his statement here is from the aspect that the men aren't going to stand up, they're not going to be able to withstand the onslaught of the Babylonians, and it's a simile, okay, if we can understand the time of the writing and whatever, we won't get overly upset about this, ladies. The gates of, and I know that you're, you know, at least I haven't found too many in college that get overly upset about these things, but believe me, in this doctoral program that I'm involved in, and I was talking to Mr. Levy today, I think he talked a little bit to the doctor's class, but I mean, you really get into some ERA, pro-women's movement, all men are beasts, male bashing, and this kind of thing, and I mean, they have a point that there is abuse of men towards women, but are we going to resolve that now by them being as abusive or sometimes more so than the men were? And then we get this big, it really gets heated sometimes. There were some men in this one that I went to this meeting that they really took exception because after a while the women kept making so many comments that they just brought up in the meeting. So then we had this long back and forth that finally they got it halfway settled. I mean, some good points to be made on both sides, but We've got to be careful we don't get caught up in the ERA movement that takes it away from the, from the valid issues. Anyway, let's go on. The gates of your land shall be set wide open to your enemies. The fire shall devour your bars. So the tributaries would be taken, the villages, the cities, and then finally Nineveh, the whole land would fall. Draw you waters for the siege, fortify your strongholds. You know, prepare for the battle. Get as much water as you think you're going to need because you're not going to make it. There, the armies, and here we have the type of Babylon and the Median Empire. You know, together these armies coming in as a canker worm, as a locust. So we had in Joel, we have a reference to Assyria being like the locust. Now we have the Babylonians as locusts. So again, it's a simile. We have to always be careful that when we go from one reference to another reference, we don't decide, hey, we have to have exactly the same simile. And we have mentioned earlier, yes, Satan is like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. It also refers to Christ as the Lion of Judah. So in each of those settings, you pull from the simile what is valid for the point to be made, and be careful that then you don't try to draw 14 different similes into one doctrinal statement that's, that's not the purpose in the writing. Verses 16 to 19, then we have the inevitable doom to Assyria. You've multiplied your merchants above the stars of the heaven. The cankerworm spoils and flees away. They're going to lose their wealth. And they had tremendous trade routes set up and whatever. They would lose all that. You're crowned your mighty men as a locust and your captains as the great grasshoppers. He's talking here that there was a population explosion in Assyria. There was a strength that they had. He said, it's not going to do you any good. You're going to fall. But when the sun arises, you flee away, and their place is not known where they are. They're going to lose their nerve and their interest, their wealth and their power. Their strength is going to be gone. Verse 18, your shepherds slumber. So the leaders were asleep, O king of Assyria. Your nobles shall dwell in the dust. Your people are scattered upon the mountains, and no man gathers them. Without proper leadership, they will be helpless. They were helpless, and they will be helpless. We can see a type of that with the battles just fought in Kuwait and the Iraqis, whose leaders left them. Some of them had left 10 days before the battle and left them with no food, so that many of the men were so hungry and starving, they welcomed their captors. There is no healing of your bruise. So until the millennium, there's not going to be healing. Your wound is grievous, and all that hear the bruit of you shall clap the hands over you, for upon whom has not your wickedness passed continually. He says, at this point he said, look, the captors are very gleeful. You're not going to find any sympathy. It's hard to find much sympathy in the world for Saddam Hussein right now, who has sequestered away $10 billion and who is still killing his own countrymen now with chemical weapons being dropped out of helicopters, not a whole lot of sympathy when you have done this to people. When you finally get caught, what's going to happen to you? And that's his point to Assyria. Okay, let me make just a couple of comments. Some questions came up afterwards, and I did do some more looking into Micah 4, verse 5. And Micah 4, verse 5, we find that on the heels of 1, verse 4, which is strictly millennial, talking about what's going to happen, and of course, the process at the very beginning of the millennium, beating swords into plowshares. We pick up then with verse 5, and it seems that Micah is talking at this point, to put it, first of all, in the time period then. He is talking to the people that though at this particular time, and as he looks ahead to the millennium and how people are going to live, that though people walk in the name of their God, in other words, they've got their own little gods and they're doing their own thing, in other words, is I guess the phrase from our generation, I don't know about yours, but doing their own thing, we will walk. And it's a projection that, look, though they do what they want to do, we're going to walk in the name of our eternal. Now, this
is not to be taken as religious freedom in the millennium. In other words, he's not projecting this to the millennium and saying, okay, in the millennium, they're going to all walk with their gods, because there's going to be one God to be worshipped then. But it seems that even like with verse 6, he goes on to say, in that day, says the Eternal. So he's talking about the millennium. He goes back to say that though these people walk with their gods, we will in the millennium walk with the Lord our God. That should be understanding number one with it. Because in that day will I assemble her that halt. So these that halt, these that have sinned, that repent, God is then going to assemble them together. He's assembling all those who walk in the name of God Almighty, the Lord our God. Okay, now, we have used the explanation too as far as the understanding.